boards, attending many board meetings of family businesses and public companies, and seeing all the issues that pop up at those.
And my name is Larry Stiebel. Most of you around the table know me. I have two companies, Stiebel Peabody, which does leadership development, retain search, and coaching, and Board Options, which does board of directors retain search and also does board of directors self-evaluation. I've also served on a number of boards, and so over the years, I'm both a psychologist, a licensed psychologist like two of you are, and I'm also a business guy and a CEO. And in many companies, I got to put one hat aside and put on the other hat, or put on one hat and take the other hat off. What I love about family business is I have to wear both hats at the same time, because you really can't understand a family business without understanding the psychology of what's going on, and you can't understand the psychology without understanding the business of what's going on. So I compare doing family business work to being in the middle of a five-ring circus. I would also say that some of my best work was done in family businesses, and some of my worst work was done in family businesses. So when it works, it's just a beautiful thing. And when it doesn't, it's awful. Jeffrey?
Well, it was much easier 35 years ago for me to describe myself. In the simplest way, I am chairman and founder of Mage LLC. For the last 36 years, and we've worked with over 700 organizations, helping them to understand the complexity of how to grow their firms and achieve their goals, working with leadership development, executive development, and coaching to try to help them do that. I also am co-founder and chairman of MTP Software, a CRM company, and I'm also founder of and president of Radio Entrepreneurs, an internet radio network that features actually right now three radio shows focusing on entrepreneurship and trying to grow that as well. I also, like I said, I sit on five family and private boards and some nonprofit boards as well. I like to say a couple of nonprofits. I have been on the National Executive Committee for the Jewish National Fund for the last 18 years, and I also serve as the chairman of the board of New England for the last 17 years. I'm also, due to the JNF, I'm also on the board of directors of the Alexander Muss High School in Israel, which is a international high school for high school students, obviously. My background, I try to focus in four areas. I grew up in family business. My family was serial entrepreneurs. My original training was in clinical psychology. My stepfather tried to convince me to run his business and that I shouldn't be a psychologist. So I ended up working for Doyle Dame Birnbach and other marketing firms, which was one of the more famous marketing firms in the world, doing business branding, strategy, and repositioning and launchings. And for those who watch Mad Men, they always talk about DDB. That's their favorite firm to take shots at on that TV show. And I also have a background in sales and sales management, sales training from Johnson & Johnson. So I look at businesses, again, from a multidisciplinary perspective. I love family business. I love the complexity of it. I love business in general. I also like to say that one of my clients, or past clients, is in the room, Scott Levy. I always like to say one of my favorite clients, if not my favorite client of all time, just a great person to work with. And I've known Larry for probably about 25 years as well, and enjoy Larry as well. And I hope we can... it's quite a formidable group with a lot of experience. I hope we can provide some value today on the case that we have brought, because it's an actual case of a family business that had to change its board. So,
shall we?
Yeah. Well, you want me to pass that out?
Yep.
Well, I think Larry and I are going to do this as sort of a question and answer back and forth on each other. I have lots of documents, and due to Larry's practical self, he cut me down, which is better anyway. Just for way of background, without giving away the company name, and if people start guessing, I'm not going to answer. Whatever you ask me, I'm going to say no. But this was a company that was in the distribution business. It was a family business, second generation. And the third generation had to change the business. And they became a packaged goods company. And they are now one of the largest manufacturer in their category in the United States today. You're already guessing, Al. You're making a smile. Okay, don't say it if you know it is. So they became, they repositioned the company, but the board was still the same board. It was still the family board. And when I was retained, the board was 18 people, all family members, three generations. And I was asked, I actually wasn't even retained at the beginning. If, you know, again, I tell everything as a story because I think stories are more interesting. This was somebody I met 10 years ago who told me when he met me that he was never going to hire me. I always thought it was interesting. And I won't even say why he did. He actually had an ethnic reason for saying why he didn't want to hire me. He said I was a smart guy and didn't want to hire me. And we talked over the years, many years. I'm also the co-founder of the Family Business Association. For those who know the FBA, I'm one of the four founders of the Family Business Association. And so I run the FBA statewide. And we talked a lot. And we started to have a series of lunches where he would ask me about just boards. And every time I meet with him, I'd say, sure, I don't mind meeting with you. I know you're never going to be my client. Because he told me once he was never going to hire me. But I figured he had these questions, and I would answer his questions. And finally, after about three or four meetings, he said to me, you know, I really like what you said to me. Could you put it together in a one-pager as a plan? And I'd like to retain your services. And I said to him, I said, I thought you hate consultants. And he said, I do hate consultants, but I think you have your handle on how we want to deal with this, and you've been quite helpful with me. And I think, again, it goes to the underlying issue with a lot of clients. A lot of clients don't know good from bad in most fields. I think a lot of us know that. But what they do is they hire people they trust. And over time, I was able to, not different, I think, than most of you in the room. I'm not trying to take a loftier position. I think Larry does the same thing, Scott does. I was able to show him that there was a path to his goal, and I was able to show him that he could trust me. And once that he felt he could trust me, I thought, you know, that was why the work we were able to do the work. There was never any pressure for a close. There was never any pressure to do work or to do billings. It was just building a relationship and trying to do the right thing by helping him on an ongoing basis because I knew that there was a need. Never thought he'd hire me. But we did the project, and I think it turned out quite successful. I know it turned out quite successful because I actually helped him change the board and create some of the things we're going to talk about. I don't know if you want to go into the questions. Do you want to let them read this thing first?
Why don't you read it?
Take 5 minutes to read through the document. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't be held to something I wrote a year ago that I remember.
By the way, just for some perspective, this is a fifth-generation business. I think maybe only 1% of businesses make it to the fifth generation. It's a very small number. And you guys.
Fourth generation.
I mean, that's a very small. It's a very small number. Jeff, you have term limits, 2-year term limits. Are these it's renewable, or is there other term limit, you know, is there...
It is renewable, yes.
For a certain period of time or forever?
They will be evaluated every 2 years, but they know they have, that the term limit is up, and they may or may not be retained after that amount of time.
Okay.
But the old board, it was...
Forever.
It was forever.
Right.
That was the fear, to get away from that. And if I can answer that also in more detail, it was important to this client that I make that recommendation.
Sure.
That person did not want to tell the family that there were going to be term limits. They wanted the outsider to make that recommendation. That cop.
Did you see this week the Wall Street Journal had an article on what they call board doctors?
Yes, Joanne Lublin wrote it. Yep. And I called her and I said, hey, how come you didn't mention me? If anybody would like a copy of that Wall Street Journal piece on board doctors, just give me your business card and I have it, and I'll be glad to send it to you. It's basically saying that because, particularly with public companies, because of shareholder activism, more companies are hiring outside experts to go in and do an impartial assessment on the board itself. Because again, the board does an assessment on the CEO, but who does an assessment on the board? And so that's what the article is about.
Good idea.
From a fiduciary responsibility, who's got the economy? The board? The board of directors?
Yes.
Okay.
Everybody heard that?
The question was, at the end of the day, from a fiduciary responsibility, where does the buck stop? And Jeffrey said the board of directors.
The board of directors had full fiduciary responsibility in this company, which was a problem with the old board. Because there were family members who were not fully informed, had trouble with the board meetings, with the level of detail and the complications that were going on, and were uncomfortable and put into the position to make decisions. So there was potential delays in pragmatic decision making and investments that could happen for the growth of the business to compete in a much more competitive marketplace. National brand management made it a lot tougher. There was a need for a change. I assume you want longer answers. So
no, no.
But you said there were 18 board members?
There were 18 board members when I first met them. They were sisters and cousins.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I remember going to a program with Kellogg, and one of the women that was in the program with me was an artist, and somehow, somewhere in her family ancestry, there was somebody named Ochs, O-C-H-S, and she was going on the board of the New York Times as a family member, but with no business background, and so they insisted that she go and learn corporate governance as a solution to having her be the family representative on the board. And that was kind of interesting. I mean, so there is a way to educate family members on appropriate.
Well, I think that's a good point. It also raises, you know, there's a yin and a yang to everything. And as you know, being on a board, you are faced with a complexity of issues across a broad spectrum of business issues. And, you know, my feeling, you know, having sat on boards for a long time, you know, even if you understand the fiduciary responsibility, understanding the complexity of finance, marketing, sales, technology nowadays, it would take years for some people who are, for some of, you know, some of the people who were on the board, they were the sisters. I'm going to use this company because I don't want to get in any, I don't want to get in trouble gender-wise, but, you know, they were housewives with large financial interests. And they really, it would have taken them, look, even with an MBA, they probably, or maybe even a doctorate in business, they might still never have had the understanding of business. I mean, I've coached a lot of people in life who just never understand business, no matter how much education or coaching they get. And they just, so I agree with you, it's important to educate them and set standards, but even under the best conditions, not everybody can rise to the occasion. My mother used to always say, only the cream will rise to the top. Mom. Still one of my biggest fans.
Has anybody ever been in a company with these kinds of dynamics? Well, let me. You have. Okay. So, tell me about your situation.
I have a question first.
Okay, sure.
We have a whole series of questions. Yes,
but when you talk about the governance, I mean, and what's on the paper anyway, the family council doesn't seem to really have any power. They may have a they may be able to put together things and opinions, but the reality is it looks like they have no power.
Right, and you asked the right question. We wanted to transition the company. We knew that there were issues for growth and the management. The person running the company, his father was still involved with the business. He had an agenda, clearly, to run the business more efficiently. And it was my recommendation that we find a comfortable place for the family that was not appropriate for the board, as the board needed to be constituted for the future. I saw the family council as a farm system, as a place for the family to be and for future family members to be that currently weren't on the board, so that we could identify the next generation of family talent. So we would put them into what I would call a safe environment, a safe developmental environment, where we could bring stuff to them on a quarterly basis and see how they responded as a group and maybe identify the next generation of family members who could actually emerge, and then we could fast track them and actually put funds behind them to hopefully develop them into board members. But we wanted that to be a place for family members who weren't yet competent enough to be on the board.
And how many of the family council worked for the company?
Two.
How many were on the council?
Of the family?
Yeah.
When we started the family council, I encouraged a very inclusive process. If they were working, if they were local, if they were if they had a financial benefit from the equity of the firm, I encouraged him. If they were like out of university, I encouraged this person to invite all. To make it as, I wanted it to be as inclusive as possible. So if even if a family said, my son's in, my daughters are in from university, I said, you should let them come. Let them feel that if they have some financial benefit from this organization, that this is a place where family can go and hear what's going on with the business. So I didn't say, you know, bring seven-year-olds who were crying, but I wanted the family to know that this was an inclusive place where real information and real dialogue would happen. More than just dialogue, there were also special projects that were going to come out of the family council. Family, real family projects where they could work together on them.
Yep.
Was the equity fairly broadly distributed to the family, or was it closely held by a few members?
It was held by, well, because of the generation that I started with were four family members. Broken into four families, it was not equal.
So was the family council to some extent proxy for shareholdings to either directly or indirectly?
Are you asking me if they were, excuse me, I'm not a lawyer, so I just want to make sure I got the question right. I only play one as a consultant.
But to the extent that the Family Council had a view of what the board was doing and didn't like it or approved of it, presumably they had some...
We were controlling the way we designed it, the CEO was controlling the agenda of the Family Council. It was not a virtual replication of board meetings in the Family Council. So that was, we were not going, this was not Senate Congress. We were not taking the same bill to the Congress for a second vote to be passed. There was no veto power. This was, let's be informed of what we're going on in the business. We decide what we're bringing to you to discuss in the business. Plus, as a Family Council, we're gonna develop our own set of projects or information that we decide as a group we would like to have as well.
Or were they the shareholders, is what you're saying, essentially?
Well, one of the questions earlier had been, presumably the Family Council had no power. And I was just trying to understand what their relationship was through ownership to control.
Was the board of directors accountable to them, essentially? Is that what the question is?
Well, at some level, the board of directors is accountable to the shareholders because the shareholders elect them.
Right.
But
the way things were redone, the board of directors was, you know, had the power. Although all shareholders were on the Family Council. All shareholders did go to the Family Council, but they were not taking formal votes in the Family Council. They would make decisions. They would think about the scholarships for kids, you know, special projects for sick children, you know. Yes?
I have a question for you. Were your board members full or real board members, not advisory members?
This was a full board of directors with full legal responsibility. They all had
full fiduciary
responsibility. They had, they all had insurance, you know, board insurance. I actually recruited some new people to the board. They brought on a national licensing expert, or an international licensing expert to work with them on licensing deals, and I helped them sort of bring that on. And some people left the board too.
I assume the reason for the Family Council was there were so many generations of people, it was kind of a transparency thing to keep them posted what was going on, and if they had some thoughts or ideas, then they would be presumably discussed by the board.
Another one of my favorite people.
She lives at Grove Street in Brookline, in Chestnut Hill.
Yeah. Did you just come here because I was here tonight?
Jeff, my heart has always been with me.
This is Marcia Wagner of Wagner Law Group. Marcia, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi. Well, I have many talents. Driving is not one of them. Much better and smarter than I, and we've started from a very small organization to now being a national law firm with offices in 5 states and also with an international clientele as well. So I'm very happy and proud and invited to be here. Thank you. And I love Jeff. That's probably the most important.
Yeah. Can you answer my question?
Alan?
Didn't answer the question.
I think he was looking at you, so.
What?
You want to pass that down?
Yeah. You want to repeat the question just in case?
Yeah.
He's getting older.
Presumably because of multi-generations and multi-people, it doesn't make sense to put more than a dozen people or less on a board. Then the Family Council was a way of transparency, keep them posted what was going on, and if they had pluses or minuses or whatever it is, you take them up at a board meeting, presumably.
Right. That sounds logical.
Well, I assume it would be, but I just didn't understand really how the whole thing worked.
I think you're right. I mean, I don't believe, and this was the discussion I had with the senior family members, that my goal was not, it was their goal, so it became my goal too. So I'm sorry when I say I. it's never I. It's really, you know, what they were figuring out, what they wanted and saying. The goal was to increase communication and increase information flow, and to make the family members who were feeling disengaged from the board to feel more engaged in a process where they were more comfortable. You know, everybody has their own level of, you know, where they sure. can express themselves. The family members who were on the board, who shouldn't have been on the board, were already being isolated and they weren't participating in the process. When I sat on board meetings, you could see physically they were not engaged. So I wanted to find a way to make them feel engaged again, and so did the rest of the family that knew them. I also wanted ways to engage other family members who had a beneficiary opportunity with this company to start to get engaged and understand what was going on with this wonderful asset. And so the process was about, yes, increasing communication flow back and forth, but understanding that if ideas did come out of the family council that were business related, they would go to the board or the appropriate executive parties of the business and they would implement them.
Jeff, I had two questions, one of which were already answered, which was, what were the dynamics like in the original board? You talked about some people being disengaged. And the second question is, how much resistance did you encounter from the original board in terms of wanting to make this transition?
Well, I don't want to sound like an ad. I actually experienced no resistance. And it was this process was done over a year and a half to 2 years, and we did it meticulously, thoroughly slow for that reason. We by design, did not push anyone off the board. But when I first started there, when I went to the board meetings, I would say that there were two people who were extraordinarily active at the outside, aside from the CEO and his father. There were only two people who were very actively involved. They were outside directors. And they were, and one of them in particular, I thought was overly involved. And probably because there wasn't enough strength in the room. And that was part of what we wanted to do. We wanted to bring more strength, more balanced expertise into the room so that there'd be a more of a dialogue between stronger parties and so that the CEO could actually step back in the room and listen more. And so so a lot of the family was quiet and backing off. Mm-hmm. Some of the family was talking as a way of just having dialogue because they had to have dialogue with the two active members, in particular the one. And then a couple of the older independent board members had become old. Old in the sense of just the time was done. It was time to retire them. And we knew from the beginning, we knew because I was told, that if we set up a proper process of transition, that they were ready to go, that they would be easy to go. The question was really about the family. And we didn't, that's why we took the year and a half to 2 years, because we didn't want the family to be presented with this and then told, oh yeah, and you're not going to the next meeting, it's done.
Was it evident that the composition and performance of the board was adversely affecting the performance of the business?
I wouldn't say it was adversely. I would say opportunistically it was not, you know, it's like the half full versus half empty glass. This company, it's found its stride. It's really found its position. It's done very well. It's grown very well. But we know that there's a lot of competitive forces out there that are a lot larger. They're very dependent upon a few clients, too many by a lot of our definition. And that was pretty clear in the room. And there were hard decisions and investments that would need to be made to deal with the opportunity for growth and the diversification of clients so that they weren't so vulnerable on certain clients. And again, I think the family members who were not as active knew that, and they were not comfortable. And so we needed to find, you know, what I have found in my career, which I'm sure the other people who coach and are therapists have found, is that I find it easy to make change with people when you give them people usually know when there's an issue, I find. When you give them an option which can feel better than the current option, they engage more easily in change. So what we did was we gave them a better lollipop, in a sense, and they went for it. And so it seemed, and I give a lot of credit to the CEO, who was extraordinarily thorough and did not fall into the problem of most of clients I've ever worked with in my life, and that is, I always tell clients, I use the sports phrase, I go, most people don't know how to use the clock. They, you know, they're not, they get anxious, they think things have to be done on a certain timetable, and because they force things into a artificial timetable, personal timetable, they tend to destroy the process. And I think this client was a rare client in that he had an excruciating amount of patience for not offending anyone. And he knew, and I always like the quote from Peter Senge in his book, The Fifth Discipline, if anyone ever read the book, he said somewhere in his book, and if I don't have it 100% right, I have it almost right. He said, the fastest way out of a problem is the quickest way back into it. I think I've said that to you before. And it's a great quote. And, you know, and it's sometimes, in a, you know, what looks like the obvious solution he talks about in his book is not always the real problem. And this client had what I would call real intellectual depth and patience to do it right. He really did not want to offend his siblings. They meant a lot to him. And too often, I'm in family businesses where offending family is almost part of the game. it's the sport du jour, you know, and a lot of families don't have trouble separating out, as you know, the business decision from the emotional baggage and history. And this person had a lot of emotional immaturity, so he made me, I would say, he made me look really good because he was good. And that's generally the case with any client. You want, you know, good clients make good advisors look good. Did I answer your question?
Perfectly.
As a result of this, because we deal with a lot of family counselors, we're big fans of what you did here. Do you find now when family issues come before the board, you're able to say that's really a family counselor? Does it help to segment things? So that's question one. Question two is, you talk about it educating family counselors right now, and we're dealing with four, fifth, sixth generations of these family counselors today. And I think it also goes the other way, where if it works the right way, the board then can say to the designate on the board who's chairing the family, hey, we'd like to get the input of the family on this particular issue. So are you finding both those things in terms of this or not?
And I apologize, like earlier, you're not a lawyer, so I can't use the same excuse, I'm not a lawyer. I just want to make sure I follow your questions.
Yeah.
And get them correct. To me, everything follows logic, and it follows one, just good business logic. I try not to get overly complicated in things. And the second thing in building structure, I believe, is we start with respect for people. So if there's a discussion that's truly a really big time business decision, people know it's logical that it should go up to the board. And we try to make that clear as to what were the business board decisions and what were not the business board decisions. On the other side, I thought you asked the personal question. Everything's up for discussion. You don't want people to feel shut down, even if they should be. When people feel shut down, look, I'm controlling, and I admit I'm a controlling person. I don't think I've ever met a successful entrepreneur that wasn't controlling. It's part of the job as far as I'm concerned. But what I find in being in controlling is the more you try to control people, the more you don't get control. Because people fight that sense of control. So I believe in having a proper format and for bringing all information up in a proper structure and format that people all learn and agree to. So there has to be, you know, so you build those proper systems and structures for doing that. But I don't believe in shutting anybody down. There just has to be a proper way for dealing it. It could be after the meeting, it could be in one-to-one, but everybody has to feel that they have their ability to express themselves, because if they can't express themselves, they're going to find a way to undermine you.
I have one reaction and one comment on this case. The reaction was, I was involved with I think it was the third generation family business in a technology field, very dynamic industry, and the company was kind of sliding into mediocrity. And they brought in a new CEO who had spent most of his career at General Electric. And so he presented the board this idea that if you look at R&D as a percent of sales, we've been stagnant at this level. But as sales has been going down, we're not going anywhere. So we need to ramp R&D as a percentage of sales significantly more just to stay competitive. Now, from his point of view as a General Electric guy, this is like basic stuff. And for the external board members around the board, this was like basic stuff. And for the family members, this is Aunt Mary depends on, you know, if you're going to increase R&D when sales are down, where's it going to come from? Retained earnings. And that means Mary depends on this for her pension. How am I going to look at Aunt Mary? And we did not have this family council. And so we had to deal with this as a board under conditions where you have this sort of cultural gap between the professionals from GE, who said, if you want to play, this is what you got to do, and the family members, and says, I can't look at my aunt and do this to her. I think a family council would have been good to get a, let the family decide on this and get a sense of the family, communicate that to the board. So I think that would have been very good. The end result was, rather than confront Aunt Jean, they sold the company. And because we couldn't deal with this in as timely a manner as your program would have allowed, it took 3 years to come to that decision. I think with your program, it could have come in 6 months. No. And the 3 years that it took to come to that ultimate decision meant that the selling price was significantly lower. So I'm a big believer in what you're doing. I think it's the right thing.
That's the first compliment in 25 years. Can I just add a couple? Only because it's public. Can I add a couple of things before you answer the questions? Because I consider my wife and I to be a family business. Even though we don't work together in any business, we have multiple holdings together. And we have a family together. My wife has owned 5 or 6 businesses. My wife currently runs 3 businesses. I'm running 3 businesses. And these are our joint assets. And when we, what I do is I think I run a family council. I just don't tell them that because I don't think, you know, because I don't want to be accountable to the process. But when we make decisions, which we do frequently, I pull in my mother-in-law and I get my sister-in-law and I get my kids. And we all get together and I discuss the issues which I consider to be implications, the business issues that might have an impact on the family, and I discuss it for input. And I ask them for all their input and their feelings, and I get it. Sometimes I do it one-to-one and I do it in the group. And then I tell them that my wife and I are going to make the decision. But we want to run a family council. We want people to know that we're trying, and I even say this to them, I'm trying to develop the next generation of my family to be responsible to the whole family. Because there is, you know, hopefully you're passing on a next generation of assets, and I need to know that I'm doing my part to develop them as a responsible leaders of the next generation of the family. But in addition to that, I work with 2 other families that I'm on their boards of. One, just because you made me remind, we have a guy from Pepsi Cola who's the president in a family business. And the other one is a family business where there is no outsider running it, and there's families trying to still run a few $100 million family business. The few $100 million family business is struggling terribly. They do not have the capability or the sophistication to run it. They don't like outsiders, and they don't want outsiders, and I think that that's a problem. And that's just a side note to the other one. The one with the guy from Pepsi, I always have to go out with the family and go, he's a corporate guy, because they don't get it, because they really don't get it. I go, somebody doesn't do what he wants, he says, he's not right, he's got to go. He's from Pepsi. And I'll say to the family, he's from Pepsi. I go, he's a corporate guy. But it's also funny, because he's a corporate guy, how he handles problems. No matter what problem has ever existed in the business, he's never been responsible for any of them. Now, I'm an ex-J&J guy, and I learned at J&J, no matter what went wrong, it's not your fault. It's always somebody else's fault. And in a family business, it's not, especially, I have a, if you can't tell, I have a, my own Jewish background, in a family business, it's not unusual to sit around the table and going, you're an idiot, that was your fault. And so I'm used to being in a family business where everybody's saying, you know, talking about who's at fault, whose problem it is. So they're, you know, they both have their own dynamic issues. I do believe in professional management. The Pepsi guy's a good guy, but he doesn't get family business either. He doesn't understand the human resource issues and human issues that exist within the family business, and it's a big adjustment for him. And we have to play that game between both sides, translating, letting him understand the family, and that's not unusual for me to be in that position on the board, and also the family understanding why he's doing things the way he does things as well. But the other family, which has refused to go down that route, to let go of control, I think they're jeopardizing the asset. I think they're going to hurt the family long term, and they're going to hurt the financial reality of what they've inherited.
Al?
Sorry.
Jeff, you characterize the family council as a farm team, but clearly not everybody in the family council could be developed as a player moving up. Can you comment on how unrealistic expectations and objectives were managed with those folks who...
Well, I'm used to unrealistic expectations from almost every single person I've ever met in my life. And I think that that's a human condition, Al. And I think most of us, I had a client call me last year from a large national family business. And I told him a story that someone told me about him when he was a child, how talented he was. And he started to cry. And he said, I've become a failure. I'm an underachiever. And I said to him, we're all underachievers. How many of us, well, except for you. Because she'd probably say she's not an underachiever. How many of us have really exceeded, and I probably have too, because I never had a high bar. But you had a high bar and you exceeded it. I had a low bar and I exceeded it. But how many of us have ever really met our ultimate expectations for ourselves in life? So I think we're all managing expectations and it affects us. That's just, and then another thing I believe is, I believe all businesses should practice a baseball model. I believe that most firms should be recruiting all the time, scouting all the time for people, should always have a list of people in all positions that they're going, and always be looking for talent. Your job is to develop and attract people to build organizations. And most organizations, 99.9% of people, yes, Scott's firm did it. It was a big national firm. They're always looking at people recruiting. But most private family businesses, they only recruit once. Oh, my CFO just came in and quit. What do I do? My director of marketing just quit. What do I do? You need to be recruiting all the time. So if you're recruiting all the time, just like the family council, Al, you're always identifying people, and most people are not good at hiring. I heard a statistic when I was at Babson teaching, that they said that all companies only hire really successfully 30% of the time. That the difference between good companies and bad companies was that good companies fired people quickly, and bad companies held on to people way too long, because they're desperate. They don't want the confrontation, a lot of family business. But the point is, if you're always looking for people, you know, and it's a bell curve, that maybe 20-30% are going to end up being superstars. That's the way all businesses are built. So you want it, and not everybody wants to be developed. So you have to always be finding people who have that fire for development, and you want to work with them, and you want to develop those stars and work with them while you can develop them. Because if you don't develop them, it's hard to afterward. It's easier to start from the beginning. But that's the way you build a great business, as far as I'm concerned. I'm making it very general. I could spend hours on this one. But again, if you want to build a great business, you have to identify those people who come in this way and are going to work to go that way.
Let me build on what you just said and try to be very concrete. If you're approached for a role on a board in a family business, one of the things that I would recommend that you do is insist on term limits. Now, in Jeffrey's case, there is a 2-year term limit, but the limits can go on indefinitely. I would recommend if somebody approaches you for a board, say, oh, that's great, you got 2-year term limits, fine. My limit is going to be 6 years. So after 6 years, I'm off. And the reason I recommend that you consider real term limits as individuals is if you're on a board too long, at some point you're going to become part of the problem. If you're the outsider, you're hired to be part of the solution. But after 6 years, you're actually part of the problem. And if you want to do your job for the company, get out. And the best way to get out in a graceful way is to arrange your exit when you enter, so that at the end of 6 years, you can say, it's my time. I said I was going to leave at 6 years, and it's impersonal.
Well, it's good. If after 5 years they don't like you, then they can probably wait you.
Right. The other thing is, suppose it was a mistake. So rather than go through all of the emotional trauma of, you know, having to wait for so long, I can just wait it out. We have a nice present for you and a party for you, and it's all just done in a very easy way. The other thing from a corporate point of view, and this gets to Jeffrey's point of view, 6 years in business is a long time. And in many industries, lots of things happen in 6 years. And the person who was the savior in 2015 may actually be kind of useless by 2020. So from a corporate point of view, you really want to always have people coming in and people going out. And by having this kind of structure, this is an easy way to structure it as opposed to make it a personal issue.
So Larry, it's interesting because I'm sort of keyed on to you. 6 years. We talk a lot at the NACP about 4 3-year terms.
Yeah.
Being ended any time. If somebody isn't participating, isn't constructive, the board member isn't a good board member, then there are really, you know,
right,
clear points where you can just sort of say you're not being used. But the length of time, you know, the 4 3-year terms, because the mindset is somewhere in the, whether it's 10 years, 12 years, whatever, that's when you sort of become.
I think they're number one, they're going to be industry norms, and a lot of it has to do with volatility. So I think it depends on the industry. It also depends on the size. Certainly, if you're looking at a technology company, 6 years is a long time. If on the other hand you're looking at a credit union, where the board has to actually vote on the loans, 12 years may be better, because it takes several years to really get up to speed about how things are really done.
Could you look at it a little differently? Because, and the only reason I push back a bit is because most of my life I've been in tech companies.
Right.
The way I think of the difference is that if you're an entrepreneurial company and you're growing, the first 6 years you change remarkably. But if you start out, if you join a board of a $1 billion company, then probably the next 10 years, you may still be growing and changing, but it's not going to feel necessarily as tremendously different. So,
I think in that world, you're right. Yeah. I'm talking about a family business.
But I'd like to talk one thing about not family business, and that is because, and again, I own a software company, and I think it's really important in all these businesses to get your structure in place as early as you can.
Yeah.
It's easier, I always say it's easier to take rules away than to put rules in. Once you have people without rules and you give them rules, they think it's a punishment. So I think it's always better to start with structure and then take it away. And I just think it's a lot, you know, I always tell my kids they have to earn a lot of freedom. But, and I wasn't that way, I started with a lot of freedom. But you know, a lot of software companies and technology companies I know, they have investors.
Yeah.
And there's always that problem too, if you don't have the structure ahead of time, where they think that if I put my $10 down, I automatically am on the board. And just because you have money and you're an investor does not make you a competent board member. And there is a conflict there, which inherently can undermine the long-term success of a business. And I think if you don't have the structure in place ahead of time, you need, just having money should not necessarily get you on the board.
The other thing has to do with friendships, with the family, in the family business. If you're afraid of putting the friendship at risk, don't join the board. In other words, if we're in the golf club together and we're in church together and our wives are friends together, I'm co-opted. I mean, I don't want to alienate Jeffrey, and so that immediately means I can't be a good board member. So don't get on a board member. Don't join a board where you are afraid to destroy the relationship.
I agree with 100%. I tell all family businesses and all businesses, don't put anyone that's a friend of yours on your board, because you're going to have trouble firing them. And that came from my Johnson & Johnson training, where the belief at J&J was that all people worked in markets where they did, in sales especially, where they put all their salespeople in markets where they did not grow up or go to school. Because the philosophy was that if you really knew how to sell the best product in the world, you could sell it. But if you were selling based upon relationships, you might sell things that actually you might not know how to sell, and you might sell the wrong things because your friends would buy them from you because they were your friends. So the J&J philosophy was always put a true salesperson in a market and put them against a competitor that is, you know, where they grew up and they're working on relationships, because ultimately, selling the right thing will win out over relationship. And I believe that with boards. If you really want the company to succeed, you build the board and you have it in the rules that friends really are not part of the whole thing.
And apropos to that, I would recommend if any of you are approached about being on the family business board, you do this. Write a letter of resignation and give it to the CEO and sign it and leave the date out. And say, I've written two letters of resignation. One I'm giving you a copy, and one I'm keeping a copy. The only thing it needs is a date. The day you feel that I'm not pulling my weight on this board and that I'm not adding value, I want you to date the letter and give it to me, and it's over. But it goes both ways. The day I'm feeling I'm wasting my time coming to meetings, and then I'm really not adding value, and I could be doing something better with my time, I'm going to date my letter of resignation and give it to you. You need to do this to show the board that you are serious about being a true outsider. Because again, particularly in a family business, you can get sucked into the family and the dynamics of the family very easily. It can be both positive and it can be horrible at the same time, but it's very compelling at the same time. And then you're part of the dynamics of this dysfunctional family.
When I joined the Jewish National Fund in New England, they gave me, and two board members here, they gave me a list of my board, and because the board was a mess about 18 years ago, and there was a list of about 30 people. And I'd look at those, and I'd say, well, what about this person? And the person, oh, they passed away. And I said, well, what about, and they were still listed on the board doc. I go, what about, that person passed away 4 years ago. And they had never, nationally or regionally, ever taken a name off a list who had ever been on the board, and they were still sending them letters and inviting them to boards. We had a national board that had about 100 people on the national board. I'd go to the original national board meetings, and I thought I was at Hebrew Senior Life, you know, on Sunday for the buffets. You know, people were rushing out for the tuna salad. And I was, and the CEO, Russell Robinson, for the JNF, literally got rid of 80% of the board of directors. He had to clean house and start over. And it was not easy. You were going to these sweet 85-year-old old Jewish women and their husbands and saying to them, I'm sorry, you've given to us for 40 years, you're not on the board anymore. And it wasn't easy, but you know, you have to have these rules, and you have to be, and you can't have people be your friends or just have them there forever. And you know, JNF might be a nonprofit, but today, and just because it's an example of a place I work, it's the most efficient Jewish organization in the world. Over 93% of its collected dollars go to its projects. Now, you might not believe in the JNF, that's okay, but the JNF is run like a business. I worked at, you know, NPR for many years. You've got to run nonprofits to make money. you know, you don't call it making money, but you got to run them like a business. So if you're going to do that, you have to have standards.
Jerry?
I use the word dysfunctional families. My closest to both of you is consultants. There are some situations that you diagnose as so toxic that you won't take the assignment.
Well, you got to understand my training. And
I understand.
My original person who mentored me was he was a professor of clinical psychology at the Sorbonne, at Columbia, at McGill, and started the Department of Family Counseling at the University of Montreal. So for English people who wouldn't know, it's probably the second most famous French university in the world behind the Sorbonne. And he always said to me, the more dysfunctional they are, the more you have to be there waiting to fix the problem. And the more they need you. That if you walk away, you're not there when they're ready to make change. So my orientation really has never been to be a quitter. That I'm always searching for my crack in the door. But I have to say, in the last year, I sent a letter of resignation in somewhere. It's the first time I've done that in my career. Because I felt that the agenda that they had was not an honorable agenda.
Can you, Larry?
Can I follow on that
for
a second? You know, when you look at the model that's here and you talk about the family council, when you didn't sit on the family council,
there's
an assumption in here that the family council is functional, which is sort of,
right.
You know, we're talking boards, but the family council. If you have a dysfunctional family council, this model doesn't work, right?
Well, it doesn't mean it couldn't work. You'd have to look at it and restructure it just like we restructured this business as it is. I would want to, you know, I always say it's like dating, you know. The first few women I dated, it didn't work out. It didn't mean I didn't end up getting married and being a happily married guy. You know, you got to, you know, you keep working at something till you get it right. You know, I'm sorry for the way. So if you have a family council that's not working properly, I assume there are things in the design that were misdesigned in it, and I want to look at it first and see if there's a way to design it to make it work properly. I don't automatically assume that there shouldn't be a family council. Before I discard it, I want to see if there is a way that it can be done.
Jerry, I'm not sure your question really is about family businesses, as it is about consulting in general or any professional services. I've fired clients. And I hope to live to fire more. Other questions?
Jeff, I'm in violent agreement with pretty much everything that you came up with.
You're a very smart man.
But in particular, I'm intrigued by the fact that you could stretch out the process over 3 years. That seems unusual.
The client did it, not me.
Well, but you might as well take credit when you can, right?
Right.
You have not mentioned anywhere that anything about the non-family employees. Were they unhappy, or were there issues and something going on for 3 years, and were non-family employees part of the calculus about how to make these changes so that it didn't become a problem?
Warren's question will be the last question because I've got.
But that's a very good question. I'm glad you brought it up. The original board, as I saw it, had employees visit a fairly open door to the board, what we did was we did set up a structure where we wanted. Because of the business goals, certain department heads did have access to the board on a regular presentation basis. There was access to it, but they weren't frustrated from the process. They weren't frustrated with the business, but they were interacting with the board as part of the executive team. And we did include that moving forward. There is one company I've been associated with in the last year that told me something that I thought was really very good about the board. And I tried to implement this at one company, and I've been unsuccessful, so I'll tell you. And I know that they're feeling very threatened. And one company I work with, every board meeting, they bring a guest employee in to meet the board. And I think it's a really good thing to do. I think it really is good for the employees, and I think it's good for the board. It doesn't make the board look like it's this powerful body that's making decisions that are going to affect everybody's life and hurt them, because everybody knows these board meetings go on. But it really has worked very well in the terms of creating commitment at all levels. They come in, they're only there for the first 10 minutes, and it's during the coffee and tea and the sandwich section, and they say, "Hi, I'm Jeffrey, and I'm in charge of marketing, and this is what I do," and they meet all the board members, and the board members say, "Hi, this is who I am," and they leave. And it's created a really nice feeling at all levels, I think, within the company. And it's not just, I hadn't seen it before, and I would really encourage it, I think, with other companies, because I think, again, for many companies, and it's not asking them to be there for decision making, you think like, oh, the board's happening, you know, what's happening, you know, what decisions are being made that are going to affect me, and it humanizes the process. And I think it's good for, and I think it's good for the board members too, because they get to meet the kind of people who work there, not hear the stories from families about so-and-so being, you know, an ogre or smart or bad or whatever. You get to meet people and get a sense yourself. So I thought that was a very good thing.
Thank you very much for attending. Please continue to stay and schmooze. We look forward to seeing you next month.